Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Rebecca Carroll. Glenda Jackson is a two-time Academy Award-winning actress, a commander of the British Empire, and a former member of Parliament. In 1992, she took what turned out to be a 23-year hiatus from acting to serve as a representative of the Labour Party in the House of Commons. In 2016, she resumed her career on the London stage in a much-praised performance as King Lear. Americans have had to wait a little longer to see her again, but she's currently starring on Broadway in Edward Albee's Three Tall Women. Three Tall Women is playing at the Golden Theatre at 252 West Street 45th through June 24th, and I'm so happy it brings Glenda Jackson to the show today. Welcome!
Well, thank you very much.
What an honor to talk with you.
Oh, please.
Oh, please. It is, though. How long has it been since you were on Broadway?
Oh, it's more than 30 years, I think.
And how does it feel?
Well, the amazing thing about the theatre is, you can work with people, not see them for decades, and you bump into them in the street, and it's as though you both walked out of the same coffee shop. And it's pretty much like that in the theatre. And people have been inordinately kind in welcoming me here, for which I'm very, very grateful.
And what appealed to you about this play, Three Tall Women?
Well, apart from the actual quality of the writing and the complexity of the play, because it's based on a real relationship, a real and terrible relationship between Edward Albee and his adoptive mother. It is very, very rare that you're in a play, a telly, anything really, where there's more than one woman's part, and if you've got it, you don't get the opportunity to work with actresses. This is a play with three actresses, and I'm privileged to be working with two who are absolutely marvellous.
The character, A, is, I mean, she's difficult. That's an understatement, right?
One of my rules is you have to see the world through your character's eyes. You can't be judgmental about her. And so the world that my character inhabits is one which is essentially always wanting to do her harm. And she has developed the capacity to be able to see that, as she sees, and defend herself. So she's complex. She's very interesting. She's difficult, but there we are.
But so you said that you see the character through the character's eyes.
Absolutely.
So her sense of herself is that she is difficult or that she is complex? How does she feel about herself?
She sees herself essentially as being almost invulnerable, despite her age. I mean, she states categorically at the beginning of the play that she's 91 years old. She absolutely refuses to acknowledge her vulnerabilities. She does believe that she inhabits a world in which everyone is wanting to cheat her in some way, because, as she also says in the play, she's had to make her own way. So she has courage, and she has perspicacity, and she's also paranoid, and she's very, very interesting to play.
I can only imagine. You mentioned the writing and how specific the writing is. What is that, as an actress, how much does language matter to the character that you're playing?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because the quality of the language, in a sense, is dependent upon the character the author has created. In this case, he Albee uses very, very simple words, and he uses them a lot, and he puts them in different places in contingent sentences. It's not unusual for me to think, haven't I just said that? Mm. But the very simplicity of the language, in essence, means that a great deal of the emotion is very visible.
And so that is by design on his part?
Oh, of course. I mean, he is writing about his own life, about his own relationship with his adoptive mother. But added to that is the qualities of being a first-class writer. I mean, that is what he is. Even though I think he's on record as saying he's not quite sure where it all came from, but wherever it came from, he has it.
And you worked with him before he passed?
I did indeed. I did Virginia Woolf many years ago in Los Angeles, which he directed.
And what was he like as a director?
Well, there was no meeting of minds as far as we were concerned, and there was no meeting of well, human beingness, really. He seemed to live in a glass case. He found it difficult to communicate directly with another human being, in my experience. I know this is not totally how he was, because I've met people who were close friends of his. But certainly as far as directing is concerned, I mean, let me give you a precise example. Our first day of rehearsal, John Lithgow and I were playing George and Margaret in the play, returned to their home, drunk. It's night. The house is in darkness. Albie said to me, now you come in and you're trying to find somewhere, I'm paraphrasing, somewhere to put your coat down. And I said to him, well, doesn't she know where the light switch is? She lives here, doesn't she? It was the wrong thing to say.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear, indeed.
So you mentioned also that, you know, and those who are familiar with Albee's work know that his plays are deeply personal. And so, you know, how does that, knowing that he experienced or knew this woman based that A is based on, what does that feel like to know that this was his experience with his mother?
Well, I was about to say it's nice to know. It isn't nice to know, because the experience for both of them in different ways, I think, was dreadful. I mean, tragic in a way. I mean, at the very frontispiece of the play, of the script of the play we're working from, and again I'm paraphrasing, his last three lines are, during her life I never met anyone who liked her. I never met anyone who saw the play who disliked her. What have I done? Question mark. But that, in a curious way, although it can feed your imagination, that's not what my character is about, if you see what I mean. She sees, as I've said earlier, she sees the world from her perspective.
And insofar as, I mean, I know that this is not the emphasis in the actual play, but of course it does matter that she is a mother. And she, do you play her as an adoptive mother or as a mother who has given birth to a child?
Neither, really, because that element of, I was about to say, she lacks any kind of maternal feeling.
Mm.
But although she may lack a maternal feeling, she is very aware, because of the society for which she has created herself, see the responsibilities of motherhood very clearly. And because she, as I've said, refuses to be vulnerable, in many instances refuses to accept categorically that anything she does is wrong, her lack of maternal feeling transforms itself into being hypercritical of him.
And so that is what becomes the relationship, or whatever sort of strain of maternal instinct it becomes.
Well, you see the relationship at different times in her life, and so there are changes there. I mean, in actual fact and truth, I believe that when Albie left home, which I gather he did when he was about 18, she demanded the money back from the organization from which she'd adopted him.
Wow. Wow. I've been talking with actress Glenda Jackson, who is currently starring on Broadway in Three Tall Women. What is it about this this production that is so special?
You're asking the wrong person, because I haven't seen it.
Fair enough.
I haven't seen it.
Fair enough. So you came back to the theater after quite a long time. You left to pursue politics.
Uh-huh.
How did that choice come about?
Well, since I think it was about the mid or late 70s, I've always been a supporter of the Labour Party. I was asked by the Labour Party to support them rather more publicly. I'm never sure whether it's a name you could put a face to or a face you could put a name to, but anyway, I was very happy to do it. And then, of course, we entered the realm of Thatcher's governments. And I suppose it was the late 80s. Anything I could have done that was legal to get her and her government out of power, I was prepared to do, because my country was being destroyed. Everything I'd been taught as a child to regard as a vice, she was telling me were virtues. Greed wasn't greed. It was doughty self-reliance. Selfishness wasn't selfishness. It was taking care of the only thing that mattered, you and your family. She claimed there was no such thing as a society, for example. And every one of the most blatant examples of this philosophy, if you could call it that, was that every metropolitan area in my country, the doorway of every store, every shop, became the bedroom, bathroom, living room of some homeless individual, many of whom suffered very clearly from severe mental and indeed physical health problems and issues, because she had closed many of the long-stay mental institutions under the guise of presenting a different policy called care in the community. There was a community, even though she denied that there was such a thing as a society, but there was very little care.
And so you said you pursued politics because you saw your country was being destroyed. How do you see your country today?
My country is in the state of, well, I cannot believe that we actually voted to leave the European Union, but we have. And that process is taking much longer than all of those who urged us to leave ever imagined. And it will remain to be seen what kind of deal, if any, the present government in the United Kingdom manages to reach with the European Union.
And so for that bout, that 30-year period, did you feel like the work that you did had an impact?
Oh, undoubtedly. When we being the Labour Party, came to office in 97, not instantaneously, of course, but our then leader had said that the driving force for his government, for the Labour government, was education, 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 and that was of desperate need. I mean, I had been the Member of Parliament for my constituency for 5 years before my party came into government, and I had seen schools, you know, where everybody, children, parents, teachers, were constantly trying to raise money to buy basics like paper and pencils, and, you know, school libraries who had about a handful of books being kept together by sellotape and offcuts from a teacher's wallpaper. And a desperate shortage, as there still is, of affordable housing. I mean, the problems were awful. But over the period of office that we held, those kinds of things were transformed because that was the party's government's policy. But as an individual MP, you essentially meet your individual constituents. And they come to see you because you're the port of last resort. I mean, they've tried every other avenue and their lives are still a mess. And that is a very, very humbling experience to be in that position. It's a great privilege and it's very, very humbling.
Of course, we are experiencing and seeing very similar things here in our country in terms of education and housing and all the rest, and the arts as well. You know, why do you feel like it's always those sorts of basic things like an education and a place to live that fall by the wayside?
It's a very interesting question, and I wish I had a comprehensive answer. The issue of housing, I think, is obvious, in as much as what we're seeing, I think, across the whole of the Western developed world, is people who regard property as being their insurance policies, their pensions for the future. And I'm giving an example of what I know firsthand, which is London, where we see these enormous developments of high-rise, terribly expensive flats, all of which are sold, none of which are occupied, because they have been bought by people who live in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. The issue of education is one that is always very thorny. I mean, there was a move, hopefully it seems to have died in my country, bringing back something called the grammar school system, which entailed 11-year-olds taking examinations. If they didn't pass it, they were deemed to be stupid. Mm-hmm. So again, you have to look at who makes these decisions. And it's always curious to me that very often the people who are first-hand experts in education, in what children need, are the last people politicians listen to. I mean, you mentioned the cutback always in the arts. Well, it is a proven fact, I think, that if you expose children really at a very young age to theatre, to music, to sculpture, to painting, in the first instance, perhaps just looking and listening, but then actively engaging in those, their ability to learn across the whole spectrum of education fields and classes improves. So, you know, Well, it's a recurring question in my head. Mm-hmm. How long does it take us to learn? You know, you're looking at a world where what is in desperate and obvious need is that all the different factions start talking to each other. And are they? No.
I have the joy of speaking with Glenda Jackson about her role on Broadway in Edward Albee's Three Tall Women. We'll take a little break now, but we'll continue in just a bit. Miss Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Midday on WNYC. I'm Rebecca Carroll, and we've been talking with Glenda Jackson, the living legend who is appearing on Broadway in Edward Albee's Three Tall Women. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we talked before the break about your long career in politics, and then you came back to the theater to play Lear, King Lear.
Yes.
And why that one?
Well, a friend of mine, a wonderful Spanish actress, Nuria Esper, was doing Lear in Barcelona, and I went over to see her, and it was a wonderful production. And she said to me, why don't you do it? And I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. They'd never let me play Lear in England. What are you thinking about? But anyway, I was approached by the Old Vic Theatre to do a play, and I didn't want to do the play they wanted me to do. And another very close friend had said to me, if you're going to come back, do it with something big, do Lear. So I said to him, do you mind if I just sit down for a minute? But anyway, we put that idea up to the Old Vic, and they did it. And it was an extraordinary experience. And I had found, well, one of the things I discovered, when I was a Member of Parliament, I would obviously visit old people's homes, day centres, things of that nature. And one of the things that became apparent to me over the years was, as we reach the extreme ends of age, as we quite simply grow much older, those gender barriers begin to fray, they begin to frazzle, they become misty, a bit foggy. And I found that a very useful tool when I was playing Lear.
That is so interesting. You know, I think about the character A from Three Tall Women that you're playing.
Oh, yes.
And how, you know, some people in my experience with aging parents and other,
yes.
Some people hold on to certain, you really see what people hold on to when they get to a certain age, right? And A has held on to her anger.
Yes, her anger, her sort of paranoia, her suspicion, certainly. But equally, they are no longer gender-specific,
mm.
I think.
Mm.
I mean, I think they are gender-specific as far as she's concerned, but I don't think that is true for everybody, and it certainly wasn't something that I found when I was playing Lear, or indeed when I witnessed people who are going through that process of discovering that, you know, age, it need not be the terrible burden that it can be. It can be illuminating, but also it can be really frightening in many ways because certainties go.
I wonder why some people hold on to anger so tightly, or the paranoia, or whatever, you know, instead of sort of just letting it go and be. I mean, I suppose A is, it falls in line with her.
Well, because to let go is to give up.
Right.
I mean, to let go. I mean, it is, look at it from another angle, and you can talk about people being passionate. I mean, if we like it, it's anger. You know, it's passion.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't like it, it's anger.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very, very close.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the interesting things. I find it very interesting as we age that those gender definitions don't hold water anymore. I mean, they begin to fracture, you know, so that it is entirely acceptable for an elderly man to be moved to tears. It is entirely acceptable for an elderly woman to be moved to rage, you know. I mean, and yet these kind of emotional hold boxes we're supposed to inhabit, we purport to say are dictated by our gender. But then again, if you look at the other end of the age scale, when babies pop into the world,
right,
they're taught to be boys and girls, aren't they? They're taught
right
to be men and women, in a sense.
And that's what I was thinking as you were talking about how aging sort of fractures gender. I mean, that's sort of gender fluidity, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What the young people are talking about today.
Quite, absolutely.
And how does that resonate with you? The sort of movement of, you know, pushing away from gender binary.
It's going to take more than 2 or 3 steps. I mean, if I look at it exclusively from my gender's perspective, given the kind of headlines we've been reading over the past year or so, I must be entirely honest. I thought, really, did people not know this was going on? I find that impossible to believe. And it's going on now, even as I'm speaking to you,
right,
all over the world. And certainly, we have been made, quite rightly, to be more conscious of it. But, for example, in my country, 2 women die every week at the hands of their partners, almost invariably male. That isn't a front-page story every week. We now have defined domestic violence as a crime in my country. And that was something which, as an MP, I met, not every single day, but I met the victims of it. And without exception, every woman who was a victim of domestic violence blamed herself. Now, you know, there has to be a really, really fundamental shift in us as human beings before we eradicate that. And unfortunately, human nature doesn't change. The human condition can. But let's not kid ourselves that it's all going to be over in a day or a week or a month or a year, because it isn't.
So you're referring to the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement and the hashtag
Yes, I mean,
activism.
I'm referring to the kind of huge outcry there was when certain famous and almost invariably rich people were shown to have behaved towards women more than badly. But that bad behavior is not limited to one profession, to one economic group. It is endemic across the whole world. And although I applaud and support the moves that are being made, what I'm saying to you is that those public protestations, we have to look at something much, much deeper than that if we are really going to transform the lives of women all around the world, which at the moment we're not doing. We're close to equality, but we're not there yet.
And what do you think it is that we need to look at deeper?
I think it really has to. It's very, very hard to know where to begin. I mean, the obvious thing is to say, okay, well, if I have a boy or if I have a girl, I'm not going to bring them up in specifically gender-defined ways. But that doesn't really relieve us of our responsibilities for how we get to where we are when we're adults. Do you
mm-hmm.
see what I mean?
It's mm-hmm.
it's an ever-growing concept. Not concept. What I think I'm trying to say is that if we expect it to be transformed overnight, we are deluding ourselves. It makes for a nice night's sleep if we think we've done it, but we haven't. We have to keep doing it. It's not going to go away without a constant, persistent acknowledgement of its existence and trying to do something about it.
I've been talking with actress Glenda Jackson, who is currently starring on Broadway in Edward Albee's 3 Tall Women. So back to the transition from Parliament to King Lear and theater and acting. What was that? How was the transition?
Well, simpler than you would imagine. I mean, the first thing I did once I ceased to be a Member of Parliament was a series for BBC Radio based on the 26 novels of Emile Zola regarding a particular French family. And the thing about it, although it was written at the end of the 18th century, his novels, I mean, how pertinent and how contemporary they are in today's society. But a friend said to me, I was moaning, and the friend said to me, oh, don't worry, it's like riding a bike. You don't forget how to do it. And I said, well, I think it's rather more difficult, more complex than riding a bike. But in fact, she was correct. And that was partly because, as I said earlier, you know, the theatre really does have this cooperative, corporate sense, because we're all working for the same thing, namely that the play we're doing can be the best it can possibly be.
And what do you think are some... I'm always so fascinated by talking with actors and actresses. And what are some of the fallacies about the practice of it, or the, you know...
That it's a game.
Yeah.
That we're having fun. That it's very difficult because we, you know, term play acting, I mean, could be a definition, but that's what children do. And I know there are actors who say, and Marlon Brando is a famous one, you know, that he's just playing. It's work, and it has to be done anew every performance. Every performance is the first one you've given in a strange kind of way.
And A in Three Tall Women is a very, very emotional... I mean, there's a lot of emotion that goes into it. That's an exhausting role, I would imagine.
Oh, but one of the truly interesting things, well, I think it's all interesting, but one of the truly interesting things about good plays is they all have an energy. And part of the actor's job is to release that energy. And touch wood, we've managed to do that. And it's amazing how the play sustains you. I mean, my worst day is always my day off. I feel more exhausted on my day off than I do any other day of the week.
And what is it like working with Laurie Metcalf and Alison Pill?
Oh, it's just, I mean, well, to say a treat is ridiculous, but, you know, they are actresses of such caliber, such originality and energy and commitment to what we're doing. It is a privilege to work with them.
And I read something or saw something where Laurie Metcalf was talking about the rehearsal period and the rehearsal time, which was grueling in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And just talk a little bit about that for people who then see this beautiful kind of polished, energetic performance.
Well, no, they're not linked. I mean, rehearsal is very different to performance.
But I did not know that.
The difficulty is that we three experience was it's a play with virtually no physical activity. And it's all in the words, and therefore in rehearsal, it's all in your brain. And we were all exhausted at the end of the day because these words were whirling around all the time. And it was really, really tough to find what I spoke about earlier, which is the energy in the play, but we have found it, and that is what, you know, makes it so exciting to do.
Tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was the eldest of four girls, and I was born into a socioeconomic cadre, I don't know if that's the right word, which we call in England the working class, and mm-hmm. for that mm-hmm. I'm very grateful because I benefit from having a very strong work ethic. It was very simple in our house. If you didn't work, you didn't eat. And that is a terrific bonus in life, I think. And also, I was raised essentially by the women in my family, where I come from. We seem to be related to two-thirds of the inhabitants. My paternal grandmother and one of my closest aunts lived just around the corner. And they were women for whom life had dealt them a fairly mixed pack of cards, but for whom they sincerely believed that life was to be lived. One of my mother's favorite remarks was, there's no use crying over spilt milk. And so they met life head on, but with great grace and charm, and I think great humor, so I was very fortunate.
And did your sisters do, what did they go on to do?
Well, they all went on to do different things. None of them went anywhere near the theatre, marriage, children, those kinds of things. Unfortunately, my two youngest sisters have died. The sister immediately after me is still going strong. They tended to stay where we were raised. I was the one that went away to London. My mother thought she'd never, ever see me again when I went off to do my first audition for RADA.
When did you make that decision, and what inspired you?
Well, a friend was a member of an amateur group and said, come along, it's fun. And somebody else said, you should do this professionally. And I wrote to the only drama school I'd ever heard of, which was RADA, and I got an audition. And they wrote back and said if they'd had a scholarship, I would have got it. I couldn't have gone without a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager of the chemist shop that I work in wrote to my local authority, enclosing a copy of RADA's letter. And my local authority paid my fees and gave me a living allowance. That, of course, couldn't happen now, but it was a great blessing for me.
That's rather extraordinary, right?
Yeah, it is. Right. And it was very, at the time, very ordinary. Mind you, I am going back decades.
Mm-hmm. But so your friend said, come along, it's fun. When did you discover it was work?
I think the first time I walked on the stage and was paid for it. The great educator is always the audience. And I think that was pretty revelatory to me.
One of the first performances that introduced you to American audiences when you appeared on Broadway as Charlotte Corday in Peter Brook's production of Muratsad.
Right, yes.
And what was that a political play to you?
Was it political? I don't think so necessarily. I mean, the politics of it was that it was being done in a company which had public funds in it, the Royal Shakespeare Company. I doubt it would have been put on initially in my country in the commercial context. So there was a political slant to it. What was fascinating to us when we did that play in London, we played to absolutely silent houses until they all applauded at the end. Mm. Here in New York, they applauded the songs, they cried encore, they laughed. I mean, it was just shattering for us as a company. We didn't know what had hit us, but it was great.
Over the course of your career, you've played an incredible number of strong female characters, from Queen Elizabeth to poet Stevie Smith. Were you lucky, or was that...
I was extremely, extremely lucky, no question. But you mentioned Stevie Smith. I mean, I met her. At one point, the Royal Shakespeare gave Sunday evenings concerts, I don't know what you call them, mixtures of jazz and poetry, and I was volunteered in to do some poetry, and I'm standing in the wings of the Aldwych Theatre, and this little woman comes up to me, fringe, hair just below her ears, wearing a white blouse, a dark jumper, a dirndl skirt which looked as though she'd woven it in her own front room, lisle stockings, ankle socks and sandals, and a rather good piece of Victorian jewellery at the neck of her blouse. And she grinned. She didn't have a protective curve anywhere in her body. She wasn't standing like a guardsman, but she just came up to you with this great smile, and she said, I'm Stevie Smith. I'd never heard of her. And I said, oh, hello. And she romped onto the stage and did her poem, Not Waving But Drowning. And I thought, who are you? And I rushed out the next day to try and get a copy of anything she'd written. There was nothing still in print at that time. And yet when we did the play, after the play, Penguin issued a kind of compendium of her work. And I thought that was pretty good, because the people who'd organized it and arranged it, her friends, dedicated it to me, which is a great prize.
Do you feel like good parts for women are being written, or over the course of your career, has that changed?
You're kidding, of course.
Yes, just to get an answer.
You can probably count them on the fingers of one finger.
So, okay, yes. You've had two very visible and extremely successful careers in a male-dominated industry.
When I first went into Parliament, somebody said to me, how are you going to handle being in a man's club? I said, that's been my experience all my life.
And so how do you handle it?
You handle it. We're women. We're multitaskers par excellence.
You said in your 30s that you were looking forward to growing old, because it seems like the only irresponsible time of your life.
Well,
has that turned out to be true?
No, I said to my girls when I finished being a Member of Parliament, I am going to live a life of utter irresponsibility. It just shows you the older you get, you don't get any wiser. Because, of course, the personal responsibility is immense. Who gets you out of bed in the morning if not you?
You're nominated for 2 Tony Awards for Best Leading Actress in a Play. And you didn't pick up either of your Academy Awards that you won years ago. Are you going to the Tonys?
Yes, I am, but I didn't win the Oscars. I always cavil at this. You don't compete. I mean, the people who win are the people who voted for whoever gets the award, whatever that award may be. But I couldn't go to Los Angeles, because I was in that blessed state for all actors. I was working.
And what do you see on the horizon?
Well, I see another 4 weeks of doing a really remarkable play with 2 great actresses. I don't work any further ahead than that.
I've been talking with actress Glenda Jackson, who is currently starring on Broadway with Three Tall Women. Thank you so much for your time. It was just a pleasure to talk with you.